Members, I thought it might be helpful for the committee if we had a little overview on the streamlined sales and use tax system. So we've got some people from revenue here this morning to kind of update us on the status of that. So where we have from revenue, come on down. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee. My name is Larry Wilkie, and I'm acting assistant commissioner for the Department of Revenue. And I have with me Judy Nickham from our staff, who has worked very extensively.
I'd like to eliminate the thing.
Streamlined agreement here, so if there are any detailed questions, she can assist me in answering any questions that you might have. I have a rather extensive outline here of the streamlined sales tax system, and I understand that the time is a consideration here, so I'll probably go over some of these slides. This was a PowerPoint slide, and I'll probably go over some of them pretty quickly. But what I'd like to start off with is just to give a background of how the streamlined sales tax project started and some of the reasons behind it. As you can see, and this is on the second page, and they're not numbered, so you're going to hopefully keep these in order here as I go through them. As you can see, there are 45 states that impose a sales and use tax in the United States, and that in itself probably is not a major problem in some of the major retailers and so far as reporting, but there is also 7,000 local jurisdictions that impose a sales and use tax as well, and that in its own right imposed quite a burden on retailers as far as filing returns in all of those jurisdictions as well as the 45 states.
Sam's.
As far as states are concerned, in order for a retailer to be required to collect a state sales and use tax, they have to have a physical presence in the state. That means they either have to have employees or actual physical location of business within that state. And out-of-state retailers that don't have that physical presence are not required to collect any of the state's tax. Some do voluntarily, but not very many. All states have a complementary use tax that goes along with the sales tax, and if a person goes and buys an item from out of state, they owe a use tax to the state. For example, if I bought a computer from an out-of-state company and it was sent in here, I would end up owing a use tax if that computer company did not have a physical presence, and there were several large computer companies that were in that category.
Mr. Wilkie, do we have any idea what the compliance rate is on that use tax?
It is extremely low. We do some what we call research and development kinds of audit projects, and the use tax compliance rates varies by industry, but I would say anywhere in the 40 to 60% range is what we find. That's pretty typical.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then to that point, when there is compliance, is that because they have a presence in our state and then they charge sales tax? Because occasionally if you buy something online, they will charge sales tax, and sometimes they don't, and I've never quite figured out for myself why that is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoll, members of the committee, generally what you'll probably find is that they do have a presence. There's a lot of especially larger retailers that both have internet sites and stores within the state, and that's generally what you'll find. Moving on, why can't the states require sellers to collect the sales tax? Back in 1967, there was a U.S. Supreme Court case called National Bellis Hess that basically affirmed the fact that unless you had a physical presence, you couldn't collect the tax. You didn't have to collect the tax. And then in 1992, there was a Supreme Court decision, Quill versus the state of North Dakota, that reaffirmed that basically. It did provide a little wiggle room as far as the states were, but it were concerned, but it still stated that a business did not have to collect the tax if it had no physical presence. So, moving on, as far as remote sales, what is at stake? There is no question that the sales and use tax, and even in Minnesota and other states, is a very complex tax, and it's hard for businesses to comply exactly with all the various tax laws. Also, as far as the remote sales are concerned, in the instance there are businesses that don't have a outside presence outside of Minnesota, they're at an unfair advantage, and we saw that over the years. You probably have seen some of the bookstores that have went out of business. That's one of the primary areas that I'm most familiar with that couldn't compete with some of the larger firms that were actually selling from out of state. And then, of course, there are significant losses of revenue expected due to the growth of e-commerce, and I think all of you are aware of how rapidly that is growing. The next slide gives you a better perspective of the exact loss that states are facing. There's a report that was done by a professor at the University of Tennessee, and his report shows that nationwide that states are looking at a potential loss of somewhere between $15 and $16 billion in 2003. In our own case, we did a sales tax gap study back in 2002, and the projection for 2007 was that we would lose $333 million to remote sales, and that is expected to grow.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was done in 2002. Was the growth factor that you calculated at that time comparable to what the actual growth has been
Senator Scoy, members of the committee, it was pretty comparable, I think, to it. We're in the process of updating that gap study this coming year, so we'll have a better idea, you know, if the projections that were used back in 2002 were close to being correct. But I suspect that it's every bit of that. I think, and I don't have the exact figures, but I think it was around $170 million back in 2002 that we were talking about. So you can see that it's almost doubled as far as loss of revenue.
Thank you.
So as a result of all of these problems, that in a loss of revenue and the complexity of the law, what the National Governors Association and the National Conference of State Legislators made a request to the various state tax administrators to look at how we could make a sales tax system that was less complex and address the unlevel playing field that out-of-state businesses who weren't required to collect tax to address that particular issue and also the loss of revenue issue. That project actually took off in April of 2000, and since that time, there's been 44 of the 45 states, only one, the state of Colorado, has not participated, and also the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico have also been involved, as well as local governments and quite extensive interaction with the business community as far as the project is concerned. The goals of the streamlined effort were to create the simpler system for administering the tax, and if something couldn't be made simple, at least to try to make have the states come up with laws that were uniform in nature. And also, and this was important to all of the states as well, is to balance the interests of a state's sovereignty with the interests of simplicity and uniformity. We didn't want to take out of the hands of the legislature the right to tax or not tax an item, and that was a very clear goal. And then also, another important feature was to leverage the use of technology to ease tax collection. In other words, not make it a great burden on these out-of-state sellers and who might have to collect the tax. After about over 4 years of effort, the streamlined sales tax agreement was actually became effective on October 1st of 2005, and At that time, there were 13 full member states who passed and implemented all of the conforming legislation that needed to be part of it, and Minnesota was one of those 13 states. There was also six associate member states who had passed conforming legislation, but they had delayed their effective dates as far as the legislation was concerned. And those states have until the end of this year to fully implement it as far as an effective date is concerned. There is a map that shows the concentration of where the streamlined states are, and you'll see those of you that have colored copies will see that most of the states are concentrated in the Midwest. Since the 13 state, there's two more full member states that were added in the past year, Rhode Island and Vermont. As far as the agreement is concerned, what it does do is provide, and this is one of the key things that the business community wanted, was state-level administration of local sales and use taxes. That wasn't a major problem in a state like Minnesota, but there were a number of states where the locals administer their own tax, and that presents a considerable problem to the retailers in having to fill out many different tax returns for those different local jurisdictions. Another important item for the business community was to try to come up with one general state rate, which ended up being part of the agreement. We don't or didn't have any situations as far as dealing with caps and thresholds, but a number of other states did, and that's basically where, let's say, for example, you wanted to tax all clothing that cost over $1,000. That would be a cap or a threshold, and Minnesota doesn't have that kind of feature in its law. Another item, and this is, once again, Minnesota did not have to deal with this issue, but there were a number of states that the local tax bases.
Senator Scoy, excuse me.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but before you go on, back on the where you're talking about the rate simplification, it says allows single local rate per jurisdiction. Are you talking about like a city jurisdiction, they can have their own local rate, or a state jurisdiction, or what are you referring to there?
Senator
Mr. Wilkie.
Scoy and members of the committee, the it's one rate per local jurisdiction. In other words, like Hennepin County could have one rate. Ramsey County can have one rate, but they can't have two different rates in the county.
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, so in Minnesota, these local option sales taxes and stadium taxes or whatever it is, transit taxes, they would be calculated in the streamlined sales.
That Senator Scoy, that's correct. Okay. It's part of the agreement.
Mr. Wilkie.
Going on, as far as the tax bases are concerned, that was another important feature to ensure that all of the locals' tax bases were the same. There are some states that have a major problem, and what I mentioned earlier about Colorado has got probably one of the most complicated sales tax systems in the country, if not the most, because they have different tax bases. But there are other states as well, and that was something that was ultimately agreed would be part of the agreement. One of the biggest issues as far as business and even ultimately for states wanting to become part of the agreement was to try to develop a uniform sourcing rule for goods and services. In Minnesota, we have what we call destination-based sourcing, and that's ultimately what the agreement provided for, but there are a number of states that provide for what they call origin-based sourcing, primarily the local taxes, and that has been a big issue in some of the larger states. Texas, for example, is one that was involved very heavily in the opening part of the project, and they've had difficulty in passing their legislation because the locals have their origin-based sourcing, and going to a local or going to a destination sourcing would cause revenue shifts as far as their locals are concerned. In Minnesota, in Minnesota, that was not a big issue for us. So, and that's been one of the one of the key factors in why there hasn't been more states that have joined up at this point in time. The state, there are several states, and Washington is one in particular that's looking at developing a revenue sharing proposal with the locals, so if they lose any revenue, what they pick up through the streamlined process, they would pass on to the locals. There's also been local or sourcing rules that have been developed for various industries or various products, and I'm not going to go into the detail of those. As far as other key features, one of the things, as I mentioned earlier, was to try to develop uniform definitions, and this is a list of the products that we have developed uniform definitions for, and this is extremely important as far as the business retailers are concerned, so they've got some common definitions. They don't have to wonder how one state taxes prepared food and another does, for example. Other key features, and these are probably some of the lesser ones, but still important, the uniform treatment of bank holidays. As far as filing of tax returns are concerned, it was important for businesses to know that the due dates, that they were certain of the due dates of returns, and all states treated the bank holidays in the same manner. As far as we don't have a sales tax holiday in Minnesota, but a number of states do, so we there was a uniform rule that was adopted for that, uniform drop shipment rule, and then a uniform rule for bad debt credits. One of the key features as far as simplification was concerned, and I would say probably all three of these are on the simplified electronic tax returns. A number of states had very complex tax returns in which they were reporting their taxes. Yeah, Minnesota, we've had a simplified return for years, so it wasn't a big issue for us. Uniform exemption certificate and simplified exemption certificate processing was an important feature for the business community, so they didn't have to worry about having different types of exemption certificates that each state has. So there's one uniform exemption certificate out there that business can use rather than a multitude. One of the key features is as far as exemption certificate processing is concerned is if a business is ever audited and they accept exemption certificates from other businesses, one of the things is always, did they accept that exemption certificate in good faith? And the good faith requirement in state laws is no longer there. In other words, it's not as big a burden. The retailer doesn't have to worry as much once they get the exemption certificate that all the dots and that they have to follow up are crossed, and that all of the they have to find out all the details about the business in order to know whether they actually are entitled to that particular exemption. The only exception would be is that they knowingly accepted and it was a fraudulent reason for doing it. And the uniform rounding rule was another one that would seemingly seem like it's very simple, but there were a number of states that used a bracket system as far as calculating the sales tax. Minnesota case, what we do is round up to the nearest dollar in and or cent, and so that was not a big issue for us. Another key feature as far as the system is concerned was that there was a central registration system that was developed so out-of-state retailers could go to one source and if they wanted to register under the streamlined sales tax system. So as far as any states that are added as full members after the agreement, the sellers receive notice from the governing board and automatically become registered to collect taxes in those states. There's also an amnesty feature that was there as well, so businesses in the first year had an opportunity to join up under the sales tax streamlined sales tax system and not have to worry about past liabilities, which was important to some that wanted to eliminate what they might have perceived as a future or a past liability. The next ones will talk a little bit about the governance of the agreement itself. All member states, full member states, and associate member states have a seat on the governing board. And right now, there would be 22 or 21 states that are part of it. The governing board, there's also a couple of councils that are attached to it. One is the State and Local Advisory Council, and the other is the Business Advisory Council. And as the name Business Advisory Council implies, that its members are comprised of business members, associations. The governing board itself is responsible for any interpretations or amendments that are made to the agreement, and there are amendments that are proposed to the agreement, and the board meets generally about 3 or 4 times a year to address those agreements. In order to make any change to that agreement, you need a 3/4 majority to pass the amendment. They also certify technology systems that there's companies that we have called certified service providers that actually provide the technology for businesses to file returns. They do all of the work basically for them without them really having to do anything other than providing information about their sales. Also, they determine that states are in compliance with the agreement. All of the states have to go through a compliance check in order to be considered to be in compliance, and this is done annually. There's also implementation as far as the administrative mechanisms. There is for the certified service provider, they do get some compensation for providing the service, and all of that compensation comes from new money that's generated through the agreement. And also, they handle any dispute resolution, which generally is more along the lines of interpreting the agreement itself, because there are certain sections of it, like the current sales or the past sales and use tax law, that is somewhat hazy at best as far as coming when you have to try to make some determinations. The State and Local Advisory Council, what they did want was to have those states that were not full member states or associate member states to still have some voice as far as the streamlined sales tax process, and that's primarily what that group of states consists of, as well as the member states. They also take a look at developing new definitions and analyzing proposed amendments, and they make recommendations to the full governing board. They also work with the Business Advisory Council on all of these definitions and amendments, and many of these amendments and definitions they don't happen in 1 month, or many of them have taken several years to develop. The Business Advisory Council, that is the, as I said before, the voice of the business community members, and it provides input to the governing board. They do have two members that are on the governing board. They don't have a voting right, you know, as far as amendments, but they certainly have a lot of influence as far as the governing board is concerned. As far as technology is concerned, there is a lot of technical improvements that have been made to the sales tax systems over the last few years, and part of the agreement allows for a database that matches tax rates to local jurisdictions, so a business can go to the database and determine what rate of tax that a particular local jurisdiction has, and all of the states that are part of the agreement have to keep that up to date. So if ever there's a new local tax in Minnesota, we have to adjust our database for that. It's also a database for boundary information, too, which is important when you're talking about businesses that are real close to the boundaries as far as within a local jurisdiction. And also there's a database that the taxability matrix that identifies, you know, whether a product is exempt or taxable, which is real important for some of these certified service providers and others to use, so when product comes along, if there's been a sale on, they can determine by matching it whether the item is exempt or taxable. All of these certified service providers and other software that's used to within the system has to be certified by the governing board as well, and there's also a lot of work that was had to be undertaken as far as developing a central registration system that was usable by everyone. This next page talks about the different sellers, Model 1, Model 2, and Model 3. Basically, a Model 1 seller is a certified service provider whose only job really is to do the taxes. It's primarily pinpointed to help out-of-state retailers take care of all of their tax responsibilities. They get the information from the seller, and they've got the certified software, and they're able to take that information and compute the tax. They send it on to the various states. And the Model 2 sellers, and I don't, a little different situation where they sell software to that's certified by the project, and a business could use that software or that certified automated software, and once it's certified, be reasonably assured that what they're taxing or not taxing is correct. The Model 3, and I'm not sure whether we have any that are in that category, it's probably more where the larger companies like a Walmart or a Target could develop their own in-house software, and it would be certified by the project and therefore they could reasonably expect to use that information that's in the software and know that it was correct. As far as what member states need to do to remain in compliance with the agreement, every one of the member states has to adopt any new provisions or amendments that are made by the governing board. Generally, I would say over a course of a year, there's probably anywhere from 6 to 8 different amendments that are made. Some of them are relatively minor in nature, and some of them, I would say at this point, most of them now are not quite in the same category as what they probably were a couple years ago. This year, and I think you'll be hearing that later when the department makes its presentation on law change amendments, but we need, in order to remain in compliance, we need new provisions as far as telecommunications sourcing. There's also provisions for updating unbundling transactions, bad loss allocation, uniform definition of fur clothing. This is probably one of the most problematic issues that Minnesota's faced in as far as the agreement is concerned, because back in 2002 we carved out the fur tax as far as clothing was concerned and put a gross receipts tax on it, and some of the members of the business community have argued that we didn't play fair as far as the agreement was concerned, that it should have been not dealt in that matter. What the governing board has done is we are proposing an amendment now that would switch it back to a fur tax. There is the governing board has actually provided for a specific carve-out for fur clothing. Minnesota is not the only state. It really got to be an issue last year because of changes that New Jersey made. They basically passed a law very comparable to Minnesota's as far as fur tax. Then there's a few provisions as far as exemption certificate requirements that need to be done. As far as strategic goals, as far as that, and with the system itself, one of the things that we hope to do and is to recruit more remote sellers. A few weeks ago, I think we had close to 1,400 new sellers who have signed up since October 1st of 2005. One of the other things, too, is to try to expand legislative leadership within the governing board. Each state is allowed to have four delegates to the governing board. In Minnesota's case, we could, and we've had on occasion had legislative staff or members that have actually been part of the meetings themselves, but we have are allowed to have one representative from the Senate and one from the House, and so that's something that we would hope that we get some interested parties that might want to participate in that process. The other thing that's real important is to try to recruit additional member states, and it's extremely critical. The more that we add, the better chance that we will have a passing federal legislation, which is really the ultimate goal here. And also, there's certain compensation issues that still have to be dealt with some of these other model 2, 3, and 4 sellers, as far as how much we actually pay to them. And then, very importantly, the lobbying Congress for the legislation to require remote sellers to collect the sales tax. Next slide shows three states that I'm aware of at this point in time that have a reasonably good chance of passing legislation this year. I know that in the state of Washington, the Senate, their Senate passed legislation there. It hasn't passed the House yet. They're reasonably confident that it's going to happen this time around. I know that Wisconsin is trying to pass it as well. I'm not sure if it's been introduced. They've tried in the past, but now they think they have a better chance, and Hawaii is another state that's on the cusp of passing legislation. The federal legislation that I talked about, they have introduced it, never gotten to the full Congress as far as I'm aware, but the provisions in it would basically require sellers without a physical presence in member states to collect and remit the sales tax. And it would only be in those states that have passed sales and use tax legislation. And there are several key provisions. That probably the most contentious provision as far as the federal legislation is the small business exclusion. And I think the last time I saw the legislation, there was a $5 million small business exclusion. In other words, if you had less than $5 million nationwide, you would not be required to fall under this legislation. There are two major companies out there, eBay and Amazon, that are at odds. eBay thinks that's a good figure, and Amazon thinks it's way too high, and for pretty obvious reasons. There's also a provision in it, too, that would provide that the states have to provide vendor allowance for any businesses that fall under this provision, and that's something we don't have in Minnesota at this point is a vendor allowance, so it's something that we would have to deal with. As I pointed out here, it's questionable whether or not this legislation will pass this year. There's a number of people think that this year is the best chance that it will have next 2 years and the best chance it's had in probably since it's been proposed. That's remains to be seen. As far as the presentation, I do have the website. If you need more information, it has a lot of the information as far as the actual agreement is concerned. It talks about the makeup of the board and things like that. So if you are interested and want to find out more, you can contact the website. That concludes my presentation. I went through it real quickly because this would take try to adequately explain it probably more time than you want to take.
Wilkie, I think that was just fine. Members have any questions? Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Wilkie. Does this address how small a jurisdiction boundary can be related to the collection of sales tax? We have the county tax, we have the state's tax, obviously. We have local units of government with local option sales tax. Within local units of government, is there anything that prevents the state, as it relates to compliance, for doing something smaller than a local unit of government? Perhaps parcels, collecting a sales tax on a part of a a portion of a local unit of government?
I'm not aware that it has anything specific that would address that. I know that there are, you know, like a state like Washington has, they go beyond, they have school districts and that collect local taxes. As Judy is pointing out, transit districts, things like that. It would have to be something that was set up in some sort of a governmental format.
Okay.
I mean, you just couldn't set aside a parcel of land and say it was a special.
And so, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Wilkie. So I guess what I'm interested in finding out, and maybe this is something I can get later, is what does govern the definition of the ability of a unit of government to determine a different boundary, perhaps in a we have communities with downtowns, we have communities with, you know, or cities with areas that have higher maybe a retail center that it may make some sense to have a higher tax, and that's what I'm interested in. I don't, you know, I can maybe talk later about it.
But. Yeah, I'm not aware that it specifically states that within the agreement itself, and that's something we'd have to research further.
Thank you.
Senator Larson, are you building a base?
It's possible.
Anything else? Give me members.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sundrum.
I think I know the answer to this, but with respect to international transactions, none of this would apply to any of that, right?
Senator, that's correct. It doesn't preclude the fact, like, for instance, if I bought something in Canada and brought it back here, and I'd be subject to a use tax, but we can't require any business in Canada or any other foreign country to collect it.
Thank you.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I'm interested in the governance structure, sir, and we have the Uniform Commercial Code, which obviously is adopted in all the states, and we all deal with commercial transactions similarly. And on the other hand, we have compacts, and Minnesota is a member of a couple of different compacts on a national level where the designees from Minnesota go and participate in the adoption of the laws that we all abide by, separate than federal law. This looks to me like it's not either one of those. It's not technically congressional law, federal law, and it's not going to be a compact because there's some individuality options here. Like, we can pick different rates per state. Are there any other examples of that kind of a hybrid anywhere else, or are you really forging new ground on that?
Members of the committee, I'm not certain if these would be exactly the same. I mean, we have compacts like the Multi-State Tax Commission, for example, that's out there. Not familiar with the title, but I know with it, with regard to petroleum, there's a nation statewide agreement there. IFTA is the International Fuel Tax Agreement. So I'm not certain how, you know, I haven't looked at their bylaws. There is bylaws that have been established for the governing board that are out there as well, that they're on the website itself.
Okay, Mr. Chair. My concern is I want to know where there are certain areas of autonomy and there are going to be certain areas where there is no autonomy. And that's something I'm sure that our commissioner is fully aware of, but that's something as a state we're going to want to participate in determining where we have our own autonomy. And I think that's one of the advantages of being on the governing, one of the original states in the governing board. I know we're probably having those dialogues right now, and I'm hopeful to learn more about that. But that is one of the areas of concern for me, because we give up authority and autonomy in certain ways, and I hope that we all recognize where that is and we influence the process to a way that we can all live with and over many years.
And our members of the committee, that is a concern that all states have with regard to giving up things, you know, there is some give and take in the process of all of this too.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Nykum, do you want to say anything? Commissioner knows you were here, so he's sitting back there. So, anything else, members? Not, thank you very much. It was very helpful. Commissioner? Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Members, we're going to have a little conversation with the commissioner here about this committee's recommendation to the full Senate about his confirmation as the revenue commissioner. So this will be your opportunity to pick the commissioner's brain about where he sees the department going over the next 4 years. Commissioner, let me just say the legislative auditor in 2005 issued a report and indicated that the taxpayer assistance area of the department needed to go to charm school, and I think I heard recently that the department was going to reinstitute the toll-free number for taxpayers. I think that's important in that, you know, we have kind of a voluntary compliance situation here with people, and I think most people want to do what's right if they know. So I just want to give you an attaboy for doing that, and wonder if you want to say anything about that.
No, Chairman, thank you, members of the committee. Yeah, we made a decision last week at the senior management meeting to bring back the toll-free number. And it was a constant refrain we were hearing from legislators and others that why did we get rid of the toll-free number? And there wasn't a really strong rebuttal. The reality is people are doing their best to comply with a very complex tax system, and the least we can do is provide a toll-free number for them to ask their questions. So we're going to be bringing that back in the very near future. It's the right decision to make to enhance customer service. We're also conducting some seminars regarding customer service, trying to upgrade the quality of the customer service we do, in fact, provide. We handle a lot of calls over the course of a year, and I think the vast majority of those calls are handled in a very professional, very cordial manner, but there's always the exception to the rule, and we're always doing our best to enhance customer service. I think a toll-free number, along with some additional customer service seminars, is going to help kind of upgrade that part of the department.
I've got kind of two additional things on my mind, and then maybe we'll take some questions from committee members. But in that legislative auditor's report, the auditor referred to the billion-dollar tax gap, the fact that there is a large amount of underreported and unreported income going on in the state. And I'm just kind of wondering what the department's response to that is. Do we have any kind of initiative to try and address that? It seems like that would be the easier money to go after than for this committee to take a look at new revenue sources from people who already think they're paying their fair share. So is the department making any headway addressing those concerns by the legislative auditor?
We are. And I think one thing I think it's worth talking about is what the gap exactly is. And we have one of the few states in the nation that actually have done a gap study. And we've looked at both our sales and income tax gaps. And between the two, it's about $1 billion. And I think it's worth mentioning that that gap is not the function of looking at tax returns and looking at actual tax return data and realizing, okay, Senator Scully owes $4,000 and Senator Bach owes X amount. It really is an academic exercise. It's really more of an academic exercise where we took IRS data and did the best extrapolation from that data about, in an ideal world, how much more revenue could we collect in an ideal world if everybody paid exactly what they owed, no more, no less. And that number is about $1 billion between the sales and income tax collections. If you look at what other states who have done gap studies, and there are very few, New York State has done one, Idaho has done one, our gap is actually less than those other states. Our gap is right around 11%. New York's was 16%. The IRS has done a gap study. It shows it's 20%. So I think, from a broad sense, we're doing a good job in compliance. Now, having said that, we can do more, and we're going to have something coming before you to enhance our compliance initiative. One component is another compliance initiative that we've done in the past. We're asking for $10 million. We believe we can net $40 million. That'll go to hire additional auditors, do additional audits out in the field. Those compliance initiatives have been very effective. In fact, we have collected more than we have estimated in the past compliance initiatives. We also have some recommendations that are directly responsive to the legislative auditor's report. One of them is requiring businesses to electronically report their W-2 data. So we have a number of things. Also, we have an integrated tax system we're asking for you guys to fund, which really is the long-term solution to the compliance issue. Upgrading our systems, this integrated tax system would provide us better data, better opportunities at finding out where the audit opportunities are, the most lucrative audit opportunities are. And so we're coming before your committee to ask you to help support the integrated tax system. The states that have done it have seen substantial upticks in compliance. And also, I think this another thing worth mentioning about compliance is that complexity is the enemy of compliance. And I know you guys passed the federal conformity legislation, which really is helpful. Every time you add a layer of complexity, it adds to the compliance problem. So we do have a package, in fact, that would help enhance compliance. I want to caution you, Chairman, that this $1 billion is not easy money, and it is difficult to get at, and we're going to do our best we can. Whatever tools you can provide to help us enhance that effort, we're more than welcome to pursue. But it is not, the $1 billion laying out there is not easy money. And I've heard people say, well, can you raise $300 to $400 million from that gap? And that just is not realistic. I need to be honest with you. That is not a realistic expectation.
Commissioner, this integrated tax system project that you mentioned.
Before you leave the tax gap, I had a question about the tax.
Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Innes, with regard to the tax gap, did I hear in committee last year that some $100 million of that are dollars that are under a repayment plan, and it's just that they're not paid back yet, but so they're counted in the gap, but they actually are under a plan to be repaid, or did I misremember that?
Chairman, Senator Scully, I'm not sure. I wasn't privy to that testimony. I'm not aware that $100 million actually is on a payment plan. My understanding of the gap is that it was truly an academic exercise based on IRS data, extrapolating what would be, you know, ideal world tax system. But I can get back to you, Senator, on that. I do not know if there's $100 million out there that is actually on a payment plan that I guess you would deem that easier money to get at.
Thank you.
Commissioner, the integrated tax system project is going to take how many years to fully integrate the program?
I believe my recollection is, Chairman, that about 4 years. We hope to go out to RFP if we can secure the funding from the legislature, go out to RFP, you know, June, July. And we would do it incrementally. So we haven't yet decided which tax type we would take on first, but we would do it incrementally by tax type. And I believe it would take about 4 years to fully get the system up and running for all tax types.
I think it would be helpful for this committee from time to time to get an update from the department on kind of how it's going and where you're experiencing some problems, if I could ask for that. And then are we going to integrate enough prior year's data so that we can maybe provide additional help to make our revenue forecasting a little more accurate and maybe give us a little better information on what kind of an alternative tax proposals, how much more accurately, how much money those kind of things might raise? I mean, prior data, I think, is kind of important to that. Is there going to be enough prior data inputted that we can improve our forecasting and future tax proposals?
Yeah, we would hope, Chairman, we would hope that the integrated tax system would provide us more data in that respect. You know, a lot of the the uncertainty in the forecast is a function of our system. We have a corporate tax that's very, very fluctuates, you know, from year to year, very difficult to forecast. We're heavily reliant on income taxes, which are more difficult to forecast than, say, a sales tax revenue. So I'm not sure. I can get back to you, Chairman, about how much help this is going to be in the forecast component of it. But for us, the most important aspect of this is having better data regarding taxpayers and non-taxpayers, underreporters, non-filers. This will really provide us with a much enhanced tool in that regard. And hopefully an ancillary benefit to that is that we have better data to provide more accurate forecasts.
And then on the business tax education partnership, where we share information with economic security, with labor and industry, with health and human services, is there any effort at the department to for more cooperation between those other agencies to maybe health and human service share more information with them so that they can maybe we can do a better job on child support collection or labor and industry, a little closer relationship so that we can maybe get some of that unreported income on misclassified people? Are we moving in any direction to work closer with other departments?
Chairman, we are. We're constantly talking with DHS in particular, DEED, which administers the UI system, constantly talking with them how we can upgrade our collections ability. You know, we are the collection agency for all of state government, essentially. We collect tax debt as well as non-tax debt. And so we are constantly in discussions with DHS and other agencies about how we can enhance that part of our mission. We will have a collections bill. Actually, we'll probably come in front of you, Chairman, that hopefully we can make some progress in that area. And there's been a little bit of back and forth between us and DHS about what the proper balance is between them having more say in where the collections go and who has the final say in whether a collection is deemed non-collectible. But we work very well with the other state agencies, and we will have a collections bill come in front of your committee that hopefully will make some progress in that area.
And final question, I think. This new integrated tax system, confidentiality of taxpayer information, we're going to get better? I mean, there was a news story this summer about, I think it was some lost in the mail information and some possibly some people's private information revealed. Is the new system going to have a little better internal controls that we don't read those kind of things in the paper in the future?
Chairman, very good question. The issue with the lost data has been resolved. We have changed our protocols regarding how the information is transported. This integrated tax system will be a very secure system. We have extremely tight disclosure laws that the Department of Revenue comes under. I think that what happened with that last data was the exception to the rule, but we have adjusted our internal protocols and our controls, and we're optimistic that that's not going to happen again, obviously. And this integrated tax system will be a very secure system.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, on that point, Commissioner, I'm just curious. You sounded very upbeat about, which is good, but I just think the data privacy things, I mean, people bringing things home on their computer is probably fairly easy to stop, but it seems to me there's so many things. You feel relatively confident we're not going to have that kind of loss of Social Security numbers and data, tax data, which is some of the most private people have. You feel optimistic that's not going to happen again.
Chairman, Senator Marty, there's no system is foolproof. Absolutely. The protocols that we were following before were not acceptable. I mean, that's just not an acceptable way to transfer information. Having said that, the biggest impediment to security of the information is not us, and it's actually the IRS. They don't have the advanced systems to read encrypted information. And so the information that we share with them, they share with us, cannot be encrypted. They won't accept the information as encrypted. And it's essential that we share information with IRS in order for us to do our job and do audits and everything. And so we have an ongoing discussion that has been actually elevated to the Chief of Staff and others about how we're on a going forward basis, how we're going to work with the IRS. Because we are exchanging information with them, and we're doing it in the safest way as possible. But our preference would be encryption. Anything that leaves our office would be encrypted. they cannot accept that type of information at this time. They've been talking for years, Senator, about upgrading their systems and having a secure system. It hasn't happened yet. And so the one area where I think we're potentially vulnerable is in where we share information with the federal government.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I wonder if the department could work a little more closely with our congressional delegation to pressure IRS, because, I mean, that's kind of shocking.
Chairman, Senator Marty, I was actually shocked myself when I had the initial discussion. We have elevated that. Jason Roloff in our D.C. office has contacted our delegation. We're going to work on it, but I guess they've had the same refrain for a decade. We're getting there, but they're not there yet. So it's probably the one thing that keeps me up at night more than anything else is that when we do exchange information, it's essential. We do it on a daily basis. That is not as secure as we would prefer.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Chairman Bach. And Commissioner, could you please talk about what efforts the department is taking to help ensure there isn't such high rates of turnover within the department so we can retain the best people possible to do the work that they need to do?
Chairman, Senator Sieben, great question. It's a constant struggle, not just within the Department of Revenue, but all state government. I think it's a constant struggle to retain the best and the brightest people within the organization. We've had a unique challenge because we've been hiring a high number of auditors to do these compliance initiatives. And we have in place what I would consider a stopgap measure. We've entered into a memorandum of understanding with the union to provide additional pay increases to these folks, these audit individuals we're bringing in. And that memorandum of understanding is going to expire on June 30th. And we're optimistic we're going to get an extension on that. We're talking to MAPE. We're talking to DOER. We think that's going to come. And that's been very helpful at least curbing some of the turnover. Before, we were having a hard time keeping auditors beyond a year, year and a half. I think we're keeping them an additional year now with these additional step increases. But I do consider it more of a stopgap measure to deal with our unique problem rather than statewide problem we really have. Now, the governor has provided for a 2% salary supplement. That is extremely – we need that desperately. We have it's difficult. I mean, it's going to be a long-term challenge. If you guys approve the compliance initiative that we have before you, that's probably another 70 auditors we're going to be hiring to enhance our compliance initiative. This memorandum of understanding is essential if we're going to meet our obligations there if you guys approve the compliance initiative. So right now I would say we're doing a better job, but it really is more of a stopgap measure, more of a temporary solution to what is really a system-wide problem in the entire state government.
Any other question, members?
Just right.
If not, Senator Larson moves that the committee recommend that the appointment of Ward Ines to be the Commissioner of Revenue be confirmed and sent to the full Senate. Any other discussion? Not all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, we're going to get started today on the department's revenue policy bill. My guess is we're probably not going to get all the way through it, and we'll continue it tomorrow. So Senate File 610 is now in front of the committee. Mr. Manson?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Jack Manson with the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and I'll just do kind of a brief introduction, and there's also some amendments, too, I think we need to put on the bill. And then the attorneys from our legal and research, legal and appeals division will go through the specific sections. But Senate File 610 is
Mr.
the DOR.
Mr. Manson, maybe as we go through.
Can I ask the commissioner a question real quick?
Is the commissioner still here?
I apologize. Mr. Chairman, I apologize. Did you already vote?
Yeah,
well, I was going to vote for him.
No, Commissioner Senator Senjum did his job.
Absolutely.
Senator Pogamiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I apologize. I did step out. I just and you and I have visited privately, and I've got a tremendous amount of respect for you. And I just wanted to get a couple things on the record. One was you're not the typical person that would be chosen for Commissioner of Revenue. And what convinces me that this would be okay in terms of experience. But your service as a commissioner in another capacity, I thought you were excellent. And so for me personally, the fact that you had served as a, I want to be careful, I don't want to say lesser commissioner, but as a commissioner that's not of as much significance as the revenue job, I think your performance on that job was exemplary. And so it eases my concern about your professional experience maybe not being typical for this job. So I wanted to say that. But then secondly, I wanted to just get on the record this notion of the discussion regarding the difference between when you're a revenue commissioner, you really serve the whole state. You're obviously appointed by the governor, so you're the governor's appointee, but it's a job where you need to not be the governor's person. Just give me your thoughts a little bit on that. And obviously, we all know you're the governor's appointee. But this is a job that's very serious. Revenue and finance are two jobs that if members of the legislature are not comfortable and the public is not comfortable with the numbers, we've all got a problem, regardless of who the governor is. And so just if you would just express your thoughts on how you're thinking about that difference. You've been both in the Senate staff, you've been on the governor's staff, you've been a commissioner of a less significant agency. And so just what is your thinking in your evolution and how you view that?
That's a good question, Senator. Thank you. Chairman, Senator Pogamiller, what I found in my first 40 days in the job is that it's an extremely professional agency. The senior management staff over there, except for me and Dan Salmoy, the senior management staff have served multiple administrations. Extremely talented, professional group, non-political, in the best sense of the word. And my job, and the governor was very explicit with this, was to go over to the Department of Revenue, administer the revenue system to the best of your ability and in concordance with the laws, just play it straight. Play it straight down the middle. That was the governor's explicit with that with all of his commissioners. I think more explicit pie with myself and the finance, because it is a different role. You're absolutely right. It's not an advocacy role in the truest sense of the word. It's very different from my role at Deed. I mean, my role at Deed was to be an economic development cheerleader for the state of Minnesota. And it was a very different role. It was more of an advocacy role. At Revenue, my job is to administer the tax code. And what we primarily are at Revenue, we really are, we're a production shop. We process tax returns, we process tax payments. We pay 626,000 property tax refunds a year. There's $3.5 million individual income taxpayers, 250,000 businesses that remit sales tax. But we are in other functions. We have, we audit function, and we have a legal department, and we have, but for the most part, the bulk of our resources are, we're a production shop. And my job is to make sure the revenues come in. My job is to make sure that the laws are applied and even-handed, equitable, and true to the law. I take that very seriously. You're absolutely right, Mr. Miller. This is the sort of commissionership that needs to be played straight down the middle, and I need to administer the laws to the best of my ability. Having said that, this administration certainly has a viewpoint when it comes to me coming in front of the committee and talking about public policy, what should the tax incidence be in the top decile or the bottom decile, and whether the 2000 property tax reforms were a good thing or a bad thing, or whether we need to do more on the FOCs. I mean, we will have a viewpoint there, and I will be the advocate for that viewpoint to a certain extent. But when it comes to the administration of the agency, take it very seriously, and I can guarantee this committee and the chairman that I will not plead political in any sense in that capacity.
Then, Mr. Chairman. So, Commissioner, you will be the spokesperson on the policy aspects also. And I think there the model that I think is most familiar to most members is the way Commissioner Wheelock did that job. She obviously represented the Ventura administration very well. But if you asked the right question, or if you talked about the technical aspects or the numbers, she always was just straight up and just told us what the facts were, even if it didn't reflect well on the position she was advocating. And I think that's what Tax Committee and Finance Committee need. They just need to know when we're dealing on a professional level that the numbers are correct and that, you know, you can do the wink and the nod, but members need to know. They need to have the comfort that it is a professional shop that you're representing, and that when you're doing the advocacy, you do it in a way that is respectful of the incredible importance of that commissionership for just the integrity of the whole system. So, and I my sense is, having worked with you in several capacities over the years, I think you do know that difference. I think you will be effective at helping us know the difference when you're talking. And I just think that's really important, Commissioner. And revenue and finance are jobs that, if there's not a level of confidence there on a bipartisan public basis, then it gets pretty difficult. And I'm comfortable, and that's why I do support you. I think you do know the difference, and look forward to working with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Pogomer, well said. Anything else from the committee? As long as the commissioner is still here, one last shot at him. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the commissioner was just confirmed by the majority leader.
No more important than by the tax chair or you, Senator Johnson. I'm just one vote. But I do think I think this particular individual has worked his way up in the system, and even though his credentials aren't one that you immediately would say is revenue commissioner, I think that he's worked his way up and has proven himself.
Commissioner, thank you.
Chairman. Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Manson, as we go through the bill, maybe the three department amendments, maybe we can take them up when we get to those relevant portions of the bill.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Chairman, this is the Department of Revenue tax bill, and I just want to point out that it's not solely a technical bill. It also contains some minor policy provisions. And just for your information, we did send out a list right around Christmas time to many of the industry representatives. It was, I think, 150 on the email list, giving them a brief description, kind of a heads up of what would be in our bill, and then gave them opportunity to send comments and suggestions to us. And we did get some of those and did incorporate some of those into the bill. This bill seeks to improve the tax system in basically three ways. First one is just kind of cleans up the current statute, so it removes obsolete language and corrects some errors and omissions. It also clarifies current language, makes wording changes that make the language more understandable, and it also attempts to clarify what the department's position is currently on an issue. Thirdly, it recommends policy positions on new issues, either emerging issues based on changes in the economy, or also newly discovered issues. And this can be, just as our staff go through the language and the statutes, realize things that should be changed, or things that arise on an audit, too. So some of those are addressed in this bill as well. And as we make recommendations, it's really your call on what the final policy position should be. So that's kind of it. just things in your packet. You should have a revenue analysis, which talks about the impacts. There are some minor revenue impacts on here. The first one is the repeal adjustment for pollution control facilities. That's a corporate franchise tax position. And if you look at the numbers, it's just a timing difference. We didn't conform to this provision as federal adopted it, so they're actually in a catch-up period now. So we would just like to get that kind of off of our form, so it allowed a one-time take their adjustment, but then it actually gains income in the outgoing years. The second item is conformity to streamlined sales tax provisions. You just heard a presentation early on about that, and that's a bundling transactions provision that we'll talk about in more detail as we go through the bill. And then there's a couple negligible items on changing the tobacco products use tax and modifying homestead qualifications. Then also in your packet should be a Department of Revenue bill summary. And that is something you can use and follow along as the attorneys will go through the bill article by article and then follow in that order. So that's probably a good thing to use to follow through. And then we do have three amendments. And we'll talk about those as we go through them. A couple of them are clarifying. And then there is one that we need to do. I'd like to, if I could just explain the one, perhaps, Mr. Chair. And it's the A070055.
Why don't you give us just a minute to hand it out?
And this one differs from the other two amendments. The other two amendments are kind of clarifying the language based on some of the comments we received, but this first amendment here, the 0055, actually is pulling two sections out, and I'd just like to explain why that's happening. And I'll wait a second for members to get copies of that. If you look at line 1.2, in that we're deleting on page 76, delete section 35. This is a section that pertains to 4D housing, and we were going to change the percentage of units that would qualify for preferred classification. It's currently at 75%. We were going to bring that down to 25%. And there was seemed to be consensus on doing that, but then we realized after the bill was jacketed that there's actually a cost to that provision, and it does shift property tax from those 4D housing units onto homesteads. And so there's about an $85,000 increase in property tax refunds, and we did not have those discussions with the governor's office prior to, so it's not part of his budget, so we feel compelled to pull that out of the bill. Also, there is another section, the rest, 1.3 through 1.9, pertain to a section in the property tax. And this was, we believed or intended, we were removing an unused classification. Yeah. This was for indoor recreational properties. We were looking at abstracts and really didn't see anything on an abstract since 2000 that used this classification, so we thought we would delete that classification, but then we did hear later on that there is a property that's taking advantage of that, and that was not our intent. We thought it was not being used, so we're pulling those two sections from the bill.
So Senator Skoy moves the A07-0055.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and could I ask Mr. Manson, on section 35, could you quickly give me the fiscal cost of that, the reason you're deleting it? I believe that's what I heard.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Skoy, the cost would be $85,000 per year.
$85,000 per year? Thank you.
In additional PTR
exactly.
To the general fund.
Mr. Chair.
Sir, do.
That's $85,000 statewide.
I think that's correct.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, Senator.
I think the point, Senator Dibble, is it wasn't in the governor's budget, so I think that's why the department is saying it probably doesn't belong in their technical bill.
Right.
Probably a good idea to
do. I
like
the idea.
Probably a good idea to do.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moore.
Well, that's my bill. I have a bill that's just been introduced that's going to try to do that. So I'm really glad to see that it's here. They know I've been working really hard on this, and thank you for taking a look at this, but if that the fiscal note is of concern, I just want to put the members on notice that I hope I get a hearing in the committee on this because it's a good idea.
On the Skoy motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Mr. Manson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Haugen from the Department of Revenue. I'll be going over Article 1 and then at the very end, Article 5, which we probably won't get to today. But starting on Article 1, I'll be going through the section-by-section summary from the department. And you can page along through that, or you can go through along with the bill. Sections 1, 13, 14, and 16 deal with indexing for inflation. We have a number of places in the income tax where we index. We index the brackets. We index the exemption for alternative minimum tax. We exemption the threshold for the dependent care credit and the working family credit. All of those, we have a separate little section or subdivision in sections dealing with how we do this indexing. The language is very similar, but it's a little bit different in a lot of the cases. So what we've done here is we're taking all of these indexing subdivisions and we're making the language uniform. So that instead of in one place saying that the base year is from September 1st through September 1st, and another place it might say August 31st to August 31st, we're changing all of those to August 31st to August 31st. The other change that we're making is only in the bracket indexing do we have any language about how we do it if the indexing comes out and you're at $10,001. And for the brackets, we index everything to the nearest $10. And so, and we do that, actually we do that with all of these thresholds for the AMT and for the dependent care credit and for the earned income credit. We do those anyway. We round, but there's no language in the statute to indicate that we round for these other things other than the bracket. So we put in language saying that we round to the nearest $10. And it's all uniform. Those are articles, our sections 1, 13, 14, and 16. Section 2 is...
Mr. Chair.
Sarah, go ahead.
I don't know if you want us to ask questions about sections.
No, that's fine.
Through. Is that okay? With regard to this indexing, none of this new language deals with the mechanism that's used to calculate the amount of indexing. It's just a function of dates and time, or...
The way that it's done is you look at the inflation that occurred from a period, a 12-month period, and then you apply that to the, and you have a base year that it starts from. The base years haven't been changed by this, so there's no change really in the actual dollar amounts of the indexing, but on an ongoing basis, we're just changing the dates. So we aren't really changing anything in the actual substance of the provision or the numbers.
Mr. Chair, that was my question. You're not changing what you're counting as an inflation adjustment.
No, there's not going to be a big, there won't be any increase or decrease in how we would have done this without this change from this law change or this language change.
Thank you.
Section 2 deals with the individual income tax returns. Currently, we ask on your individual income tax, your M-1, that you give us your date of birth. The date of birth is not something that is required by the statute. 90% of the people do fill in their date of birth. There are about 10% of the people like me who don't put it on their return. What this provision would do, it would say that you have to put your date of birth on the return to get that other 10% to give us their date of birth. We want the date of birth basically for identification purposes. We think we need four things to identify a person when somebody calls the Department of Revenue. To make sure we're talking to the person whose return we're discussing, we need to know their Social Security number, name, address, and we'd like a fourth indicator, which is date of birth. And if we don't have that, you know, if our Senator Scully calls in and he says, I want to discuss my 2006 Minnesota or 2005 Minnesota income tax return, we would ask him for a Social Security number, what his address is, what his name is naturally. And then we'd probably ask him, well, what's your date of birth so that we can more or less determine that, yes, this is Senator Scully instead of me. So it's one of those things that we'd like to have, and that's why we're asking for the date of birth be a requirement that you put on your individual income tax return. Section 3 deals with
Senator Johnson, on this section.
Mr. Chairman, my concern with this date of birth thing is, first of all, you've got the Social Security number. Nothing identifies a person better than that, number one. But number two, more and more because of identity theft issues, I'm refusing to give my date of birth. I started doing that about 2 years ago. And I just really oppose this part of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, all of the data that's on your income tax return is private data, and we can't disclose it to anybody else. So as far as, you know, this leading to identity theft, that shouldn't happen. I'm saying shouldn't. It's possible that it could, but it's unlikely. The other thing is that we're using the date of birth to prevent somebody from using your data to steal your identity, in other words, discussing your tax information.
Mr. Chairman, to Senator Johnson, also, the Social Security number is the best number, but if there's an error on that, if there's a transpositional error or something, this will help us identify what that correct SS number should be based on a prior filing or something, too. So that's another way that it helps us.
But Senator Johnson, anything more?
Yeah, I'd like to prepare an amendment to have it removed.
Well, I think on that, Senator Johnson, we're gonna just try and get through the bill, and then council has been working on an amendment to take a number of things out of the bill, so it is purely a technical bill, and things that aren't purely technical will likely be carried in the omnibus bill. So you'll have another whack at it.
Thank you.
And we don't. That amendment's not prepared yet to really slim this bill down, so we'll be doing that on another day.
Section 3 deals with withholding and employers submitting W-2s to the state. The legislative auditor report more or less thought that we could make more use of W-2 information that the department gets. The problem is that we get about, if I remember correctly, about 25% of the W-2s come in, or no, I think about 25% of the W-2s come in for employees on paper, which is very hard to use in any manageable way. We have quite a few of those that are coming in on paper. So what this provision does, it would say that we would be changing our current requirement for where an employer has to send in the W-2s electronically. Current law says that if they have more than 250 W-2s that they're sending in federally, that they have to submit them electronically for federal, and then they'd have to submit them electronically for Minnesota. That's current law. What we're saying is that if they have, starting in 2007, if they have more than 100 employees working in Minnesota, that they will have to submit those electronically for Minnesota purposes, even though they might not have to for federal purposes. The requirement goes down to 50 or to 25 for 2008, and then down to 10 for 2009.
Senator, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Haugen. How do you deal with an employer who has seasonal or short-time employees? If you're a two-person shop and for 1 week of the year you bring on 8 people to help out and then they're not your employees anymore, so you reach this magic 10 in 2009, would you be required to file electronically all year then?
Mr. Haugen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, you only do this once a year. I mean, this is actually submitting the information return, the W-2s. It's not for the depositing or the quarterly returns. This is just at the end of the year telling us how much that person made, and then also how much Minnesota withholding there was that was being done for that person. But yes, it would. When they submitted their W-2s at the end of the year, if we were out in 2010, they would have to submit them electronically.
Mr. Chair, I think this might be a little policy question that we should talk about in a little longer. I don't believe this is technical.
Mr. Manson, did the House think it was technical?
Mr. Chairman, the House did keep this provision in the bill, and I just like. You know, in my introduction, I said this is not a technical bill, solely technical bill. There is some minor policy provisions in here. What the House did in there was remove the controversial provisions. This was not one they took out of the bill, though. This remained in the bill.
Thank goodness for the Senate.
Senator Scoy, would you like council to include taking that out?
Mr. Chair, it's not something.
Technical bill.
Yeah, I'd be happy to have some discussion with the department about where they go on this, but you know, this is a pretty big change for a number of employers.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just comment.
Mr. Manson.
These taxpayers are currently required to file their returns electronically. They have for 3 or 4 years now, so that they have that ability. We get 100% of our withholding returns in electronically, so it's not a complicated thing that they have to do. It's quite simple to do this process. In fact, we have it online now, and came online, I think it was December 26th, and 28,000 employers used it, and they filed over 300,000 W-2s already, and this is just since December. So it's something you know, they like, and it's something that the Office of the Legislative Auditor thought was very important that we get this information concurrently with the filing of their return, so we can make that match up before a refund goes out where they may have overclaimed their withholding. And currently, I believe we get the tapes later on in the year, so we can't do that matching, you know, at the appropriate time. And this would allow us to do that matching up front. And like I said, that was a recommendation of the administrative law, legislative auditor.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Manson, you said that these size businesses are currently required to file electronically for their what size businesses that what's the limit on that size?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scully, all withholding returns and sales tax returns are required to be filed electronically.
Every business.
Correct.
Thank you.
Senator Scully, you still have the same concern?
Well, less concern than I had earlier.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, when we did that, when we made that change, I heard an awful lot of complaints from small businesses in my district and from throughout the state, actually. And I'm concerned about it again. If we keep changing the technological requirements, we have some businesses that may be not filing these reports because they can't. I mean, I would not condone that. I don't think anybody would. And this fear factor is an issue. So I think if we could take it out, it would at least allow those businesses that are concerned about it to contact us and let us know they're concerned about it.
Mr. Manson, is there any kind of a waiver process for businesses that just aren't set up to do electronic type filing?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Vicki Dickinson. I'm the Director of Withholding Tax, and yes, there is a provision that if it is a hardship, they can request a waiver.
And we have small businesses that have done that?
Right now, it's the only people that are required to submit their W-2s electronically are those with over 250. So, I mean, they're not small businesses, but yes, some of them do request waivers.
But on the collection of sales tax, where they're filing electronically, is there a waiver process there?
In the filing of sales tax, I'm not sure whether there is a waiver or not. In the filing of the withholding tax returns, the employers can always call us, and we do what we call an operator assisted, where we'll take their information and just data enter it for them over the phone.
We know, Mr. Manson, on the sales tax, if there's any kind of a waiver, if it's all being collected electronically now?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's the same type of waiver. They can call in and we'll input the information for them. At least I know that was in the early years when we first started, so I'm sure we'd continue to do that with a new taxpayer as well.
Senator Ortman, does that help?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that that's true, and I heard from employers that they did not have that they were phasing out the phone inability. So I'd like to confirm that there is some other way to file for all employers, regardless of their size.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, they can call our office if they call that the general number. We'll take their information and enter the return for them.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Are they aware of that? I mean, is it part of your forms? Is it all recognized on there?
In the instructions, it basically tells them that we'd prefer they do it over the internet. If they're not able to do it over the internet, there's a 1-800 number that they can do a touch tone kind of a thing. And then if they still have questions, they can call our general number. If they call our general number, we'll take the information and do it right over the phone.
And that's in the instructions?
It does not say we'll do it over the phone if you have problems. It says if you have problems, call us.
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, I'm with Senator Ortman on this. I think that this this sales tax thing was real controversial. We're expanding this down. And to the department, I'm pretty sure that your agency is really discouraging people from using the call-in mechanism, because I have received concerns about going to this total electronic operation, and actually I believe from what I was being told that the department has the authority to go into the checking account and withdraw the money out, and I mean it's some of the businesses have some pretty big concerns about what's going on, and I think that Senator Ortman's right. I don't think businesses know that they could still continue on with the dial-in if they wanted to.
Mr. Haugen, continue.
Sections 4 and 5 deal with information returns, 1099s, where under current Minnesota law, most of the 1099s, unless there's Minnesota withholding on the 1099, which is a rare occasion or a rare occurrence, the person that's paying out or giving out the 1099s to the taxpayers is not required to send them to the Department of Revenue. They send them to the Internal Revenue Service, and then the Internal Revenue Service, after a certain period of time, sends us tapes of the 1099s. The other route...
But, Mr. Haugen, what is a certain period of time?
6 months. So we get the 1099 information, and basically we sort of let the federal government do the matches for the 1099s that they receive on the taxpayer's 1040, and then we piggyback on that. So we currently don't ask for the 1099s automatically be sent in. The statute provides that if we do want the 1099s, we can ask the payor to send the 1099s in. Then the payor has 60 days to send those in. If they don't, then we can penalize them. What this provision 5 and 6 would do, it would say that if you're paying your mutual fund and you're paying out federal tax-exempt dividends, in other words, interest on municipal bonds from out of Minnesota, that you have to send that report to the Department of Revenue automatically without the Department of Revenue asking for it. So you'd have until March 31st or March 15th of the year to get those to the Department of Revenue, otherwise we could penalize you. Section 6 deals with partnership returns and partnership and S-corporation returns. We've had the problem where mostly with large partnerships and large S-corporations where they have a large number of partners or shareholders. What happens is they send us what are called K-1s or MKPs for Minnesota purposes. That has the taxpayer's Social Security number or federal tax ID number of the partner or the shareholder if they're a corporation. In some cases, these partnerships or these S-corporations, on these information returns that they give us the wrong Social Security number. They transpose a number, they make a 6 into a 9 or whatever. So what happens is we sort out that, yeah, it's this Social Security number should be this to match this taxpayer. And we usually do a fairly good job of figuring out who's who. We then notify the partnership or the S-corporation, you know, those K-1s that you sent us, this individual partner's Social Security number was incorrect. Could you please change it? Well, the next year we get the same K-1s, and it has the same mistake because they keep on using the same tape and they don't change. What this provision would say is if the Department of Revenue, tells a partnership or an S-corporation that they've got a bad Social Security number and we ask them to change it, and then the next year they don't, we can then start penalizing them $50 for each time they give us a bad SS number for that name. Section 7 is another penalty provision dealing with property tax refund. This is somewhat...
Mr. Hogan, Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair and committee, I'm only going to say this once, but as I look through this, there is an awful lot of penalties being increased in this technical bill. I'm looking at the summary. It's penalty for failure to do this, penalty for failure to do that. I mean, how did you operate before? It seems to me an awful lot, and I'm only going to say this on this one time, but I don't quite understand it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. You know, Senator Scoy, I had almost the exact opposite response. I didn't look at all the penalties, and I'm always worried about the penalties, but you almost want the users to pay, right? Why should we pay for these out-of-compliance tax filers
And when I looked at this one in particular, I thought it almost seems intentional. Now, you've transposed the number, you've been notified that you've transposed the number, and you still haven't provided correct and accurate information. Almost looks intentional. And then I thought, well, $50. I mean, how much does it really cost the department to go back after these tax filers with inaccurate information? I'm not saying I like penalties. I don't. But I also like the idea that if these folks are causing us that much extra work through their carelessness and then their lack of concern about it, then maybe we should go and collect the costs it takes to go and get the information that we need to do our work. And that might not be an argument that applies throughout the bill, but in that one instance, I think maybe it's a good argument for that one provision. But overall, I hope we will look at the penalties and what we're changing and why, and have a good rule of thumb about why we're doing it and what we're accomplishing.
And Senator Artman, I believe you might be right in this one instance. Isn't
right.
That's why I'm just going to say it this one time. And I don't know if all this penalty stuff is just purely technical or not, and I'll listen to the department, but it seems like there is an awful lot of it going on.
Mr. Haugen, continue.
Mr. Chairman, Section 7 is a change in one of the existing penalties. It's the penalty for negligently filing a property tax refund. The current penalty says that the penalty, if you're negligent in filing your property tax refund, is 10% of the amount that you're allowed. This change would say that the penalty is 10% of the amount that we disallow. So there would be winners and losers in this. In the situation where we disallow less than half of the property tax refund that's being asked for, actually the taxpayer's penalty would go down. If, on the other hand, we're disallowing more than half of the property tax refund that was claimed on the return, then those people will be paying a little bit bigger penalty. The old penalty the punishment didn't seem to fit the crime. For instance, if you negligently ask for a property tax refund of $1,000 and you really weren't entitled to anything, the penalty under the current law is zero. There's no penalty. Here, on the other hand, the penalty would be $100 because you negligently claimed $1,000. So this one we think just sort of makes sense. Section 8 deals with a new penalty, not a new penalty, but a penalty that was put in last year dealing with tax shelter disclosure. This actually is a technical change. When we reference the ability to get out from under that penalty, we reference the reasonable cause penalty abatement type of situation. Actually, what they should have been referencing is the way that you get out of a substantial understatement penalty. So we're just changing the reference to the right site there. Section 9 deals with income tax preparers. What this provision would do, it would say that an income tax preparer, where they're preparing, getting paid, they're a paid preparer, they're doing a lot of returns, they would have to put their federal tax identification number that they put on their returns that they prepare federally. We would say that they'd have to put the same number on the Minnesota M1. If they don't, we could assess them this new $50 penalty. Sections 10, part of 11, and 20 deal with getting rid of the pollution control facility addition and subtraction. This provision goes quite a ways back. It was a provision where federally they said that if you were a utility and you were burning this coal that was fairly dirty and you put in certain equipment, you could depreciate it more rapidly than you could under the standard way of depreciating things. Minnesota decided way back when that we wouldn't adopt that. You'd have to depreciate it the same way. So the way that you do it is you'd have an addition the first year you put it into service. Then as you went along, you'd get a subtraction, making up for that as you went along. It didn't apply very often to Minnesota because Minnesota utilities don't burn that type of coal and don't use that type of equipment. So it didn't apply to very many people. So what this would do, in Section 10, we'd get rid of the addition for new equipment. Section 11 gets rid of the subtraction completely. And then Section 20 says that if you've got any remaining subtraction left after 2006, you can take it all in 2007, and that's where the revenue impacts show up on the page on the revenue analysis. It's $50,000 for the first or fiscal year 2008. Then we actually gain $20,000 and $20,000 and $10,000, gain the $50,000 back in 9, 10, and 11. So those are those three. Section 11, subtractions from federal taxable income. This is a corporate change dealing with last year. What happened was is federally they changed the federal public law dealing with how banks that are in foreign countries and insurance companies in foreign countries are taxed. We had we have a modification for those, both in addition if they have income or a subtraction. They have an addition if they have income, and they have a subtraction if they have losses. We did change the public law reference in the additions. We neglected to do it in the subtraction portion of it. That's the 290.019D, and now we're changing that to get to the right federal public law number. Section 11 also has a change. We're changing the name of the work opportunity credit. It's now the federal jobs credit, so that's just a technical change, more or less making that correspond to what it's actually called now. It also gets rid of, we're down in the next bullet for the Section 11, subtraction for environmental tax refunds. Those are obsolete. They aren't any longer paid, so we're getting rid of the subtraction for those. Section 12 deals with the bovine testing credit. And what that one does is it says that if you're in a year when federal tuberculosis testing for bovines isn't required, then you no longer can get the credit. I think the way that it's written now, let's say that in 2007 or 2008, that the federal government says, okay, you don't have to test any more cows. Then in 2009 and thereafter, there wouldn't be any credit available for expenses incurred. I think we'd prefer to have a little bit of change in the language so that if then in 2011 we had another cow that had tuberculosis and testing started again, this would kick back in when that occurred. But we'd need a little bit of a language change to get to that one.
Yeah.
Section 15 deals with the military service combat credit that just started up this year. And the change that we're putting in here would just affect the people for the 2006 amount that they're claiming, which is for combat service that they performed from September 11th, 2001 through the end of 2006. The old law more or less said that if the person had died before 2006, that the only way that we'd pay out this credit was, one, if you died as a result of injuries in the combat zone or in the combat zone, and then we'd only pay it if you had a surviving spouse or a dependent child. What this change would do would say that for this one that we're paying out this year, basically we don't care where you died as long as you served in the combat zone, and we don't care if you have a surviving spouse or dependent. If you died, your heirs are going to get that credit or that refund regardless. So that's that change.
And how much is the credit, Mr. Hogan?
The credit, I think, is $59 for each month of service that they serve in the combat zone. So 12-month period, you could have, what is that, $600? No, $720 or $710. I suppose it's possible that you could have had two tours in there, so it might be $1,400. But there have been casualties and people who under the current law wouldn't be able to get the credit, and so this would be somewhat of a revenue loser for those ones that aren't covered by the current law. Section 17 is another corporate franchise change that is just technical, where we're more or less just changing a site to the present statutes. Section 18 deals with the property tax refund. And it's sort of a result of the 2005 change to the federal definition of who's a qualified child and who can be a dependent. Back before that, to be a dependent, somebody had to have provided more than 50 per, 50% of the support for that person before they could be a dependent. So in the situation where you had a child, you were on welfare, welfare provided 60% of the support or 100% of the child support. Basically, that child couldn't be your dependent for property tax purposes. So Minnesota put in a provision saying that you disregard welfare. And so if the parent provided 10% and welfare provided the other 90%, that person could be a dependent for the property tax refund. In the 2005 federal legislation, they changed the definition of a dependent so that to be a dependent, you were going to be a dependent as long as the child or the person didn't provide more than 50% of their own support. So a person who is getting 60% of their support from welfare, they haven't provided more than 50% of their own support, so they are going to be somebody's dependent. So we no longer need the language that we had in the property tax refund making these people dependent, so we're striking that obsolete sort of language. Section 19 deals with the estate tax. Federally, what this says, it more or less reinstates what we used to have, where if a person dies, they file an estate tax return. On that estate tax return, they're supposed to put the fair market value of the assets that they have in the estate that the person had when they died. Under the current law, it's sort of unclear whether the Department of Revenue, more or less independently of the Internal Revenue Service, can go in and say, well, this farmland that you have out here, you've got it down at $200 an acre. Your neighbor's property sold at $1,000 an acre. We think, you know, the values were understated. Under the current law, unless the IRS challenges that valuation, it's unclear whether the Department of Revenue can go in and independently challenge the valuation. So this change would reinstate what we had back in 1984, saying that the department has the ability to go in and challenge valuations that are on a federal estate or on a Minnesota estate tax return.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Haugen, would you expect that you'd only be challenging the valuations if you thought it was too low, or do you think you could anticipate in a situation where you'd go the other way?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, I can imagine where you would have a situation, because what happens is the value that you put on the estate tax return, that becomes your tax basis. So there would be, you know, if you weren't paying any federal estate tax, there would be an incentive to overstate the values so that when you sold the property, there would be less gain or a loss that you could actually get an income tax benefit from. So there would be situations where you'd want to go in, you know, the department would want to go in and say, well, wait a second, this boat that you've got down there listed at $90,000 is really only worth $10,000. It's not going to occur that often. And it would be one of those things that, I don't know, auditors are more or less trained to look for additional taxes. And this would be more of a long-term type thing that probably would escape attention in a lot of cases.
And Mr. Chair, currently you review them, but you don't know if you have authority to challenge the IRS is doing or not.
Well, it's not the IRS. It's what the taxpayer is doing. So in a lot of cases, the taxpayer files an estate tax, or the estate files an estate tax return, and they list the values. And let's say the IRS doesn't, you know, it's too low for the IRS to look at, or for one reason or another, they haven't looked at it. Then we would, at the very least, in those situations, we'd like the authority to come in and challenge those valuations.
So, Mr. Chair, if the IRS has made a valuation determination, you'd agree with that. It's only if they haven't.
That's correct.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
That was that. Pollution control.
Okay. Back here.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Greg Heck, and I'm an attorney with the department. I'll be going through Article 2, the sales use tax article. As you've been previously told, there are a number of streamlined changes in this bill. We've adopted the ones that we have to adopt in order to be in compliance. There were some options that the state was granted under streamline. We adopted the options that most closely reflected the current law in Minnesota to keep it as closely revenue neutral as possible. Section 1 clarifies what the statute of limitations period is for claiming bad debt deduction for sales tax. It's basically 3.5 years after the bad debt was written off in the taxpayer's books and records and was eligible to be claimed as an income tax bad debt or within 1 year after they actually claimed it on the federal income tax return. It also provides that if the taxpayer reclaims previously claimed bad debts, they have to proportionally relate it back to sales tax. Sections 2 and 37 of the bill would change the interest date on Border City refund claims from 90 days after the refund claim is filed with the commissioner. We've only received 2 Border City claims in the last 2 years. This has largely been replaced by Job Z provisions anyway. Section 3 is a technical change relating to penalties for local taxes. Basically, now there's a penalty if you improperly report local general sales taxes, and we would extend this now to any other local taxes that the department administers, such as lodging, restaurant, or liquor taxes. Section 4 relates to another provision later in the bill, Section 34. Section 34 would require liquor distributors, wholesale liquor distributors, to file an annual report with the commissioner listing the amount of quantity of liquor they had sold to retailers in the previous calendar year. An annual filing due by February 28th of the following year. And Section 4 then would impose a penalty if they fail to file that report with the commissioner. It would be a $500 penalty, or it would go up to $1,000 if that failure was an intentional failure to file that report. Section 5 relates to the number of items that are subject to sales tax in the base. The first one would be telecommunication services. Under Streamline, we had to adopt the streamlined definition of telecommunications services. And we've, in addition to that, now we've picked up all the services, including ancillary services, which I'll later explain to you, to keep our base as consistent as it is currently. There's a minor clarification change on the delivery of aggregate. And this would basically, we've issued a revenue saying that aggregate, if it's substantially delivered, it would be treated as an improvement to realty. We're clarifying what the term substantially in place means. There's a clarification as to exterminating services. Currently, we tax exterminating services in Minnesota. We're also clarifying that that would include pest control services, which don't require the killing or total extermination of the animal, such as getting woodpeckers out of your house or live trapping raccoons coming down the chimney.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to this aggregate provision, could you be a little more detailed about what exactly this additional language is clarifying?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, in our revenue notice, we basically said if the person delivering the aggregate put it substantially in place, it would be treated as an improvement to realty. It has been interpreted out there, substantially in place would be delivering it someplace on the site, putting it in a pile, and later move to another location. What we're providing here is the definitions that's consistent the way it's treated under the DOT regulations. Basically, substantially in place means it has to be dumped directly from the truck or from a spreader attached to the truck at the place where it's going to be leveled, graded, or compacted. It cannot be dumped in a pile and later moved to another location. If it's actually dumped in a pile and later moved, it would be treated as a sale of tangible personal property and not an improvement to realty.
Mr. Chair, so if it's dumped in a pile, it's taxed, and if it's spread,
taxed.
It's not.
Senator Scoy, that is correct. It would be taxed.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just clarify.
Manson.
This is currently the department's position, and we were going to publish a revenue notice on this issue. And generally, when we do that, we run it by the impacted industries just to kind of, you know, get their support or at least their comments on this. And this was... they were opposed to our position on this, and both the contractors and the aggregate producers. And they had meetings, I think 3 or 4 meetings, up through Christmas, and they really prefer a different approach. And I hate to speak for them, but I think they're leaning towards taxing all of it instead of determining the taxation based on how it's placed So it's just simpler for them, and so when they enter contracts, they know up front whether when they're bidding on contracts whether that's going to be taxable or not. So this provision that might need some more discussion, I think. We just thought we wanted to get out our position here, since we couldn't do it through a revenue note, to kind of get the issue on the table. And I think we probably need to discuss this more with the industry a little bit. But
okay, thank you. So you're expecting that we'll have some more discussion on this provision before it goes forward in this bill?
I think we should, yeah. Yeah. This is kind of our interpretation, but I think the industry prefers a little different approach, and we probably should have some more discussion.
Sir, the House took it out as not being technical, okay. So we'll probably take it out in our amendment also.
Okay, thank you.
And consider it in the omnibus bill, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, House staff is drafting some language that would conform to what the industry wants, so I suspect we'll be seeing that down the line here.
Okay.
I don't think the department's opposed to that. The industry proposal would actually be easier for the department to administer, but it will result in a tax increase. What we were proposing here would be more revenue neutral.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Haugen, along we're talking about aggregate, taconite tailings as aggregate. I believe one of the mines up north is just in the process of delivering 30,000 tons of tailings to the state of Illinois for some kind of a demonstration highway project. Is that sale taxable?
Mr. Chairman, it wouldn't be sales taxable in Minnesota here, but in Illinois it's possible it could be, depending on what their tax base is, yes. Basically, Minnesota sales would have to be a transfer of title possession to the state, so it would go under the destination state's law.
Well, I think what happens is the mining company who owns the tailings are not going to deliver it directly. They're going to contract with somebody to deliver it, whether it's Canadian National Railroad or somebody. But it just seems to me if there's another party involved and the mining company's actually selling the tailings to a vendor who's then going to deliver it.
Well, as far as that goes, I think Minnesota is one of the few states with tax third-party delivery charges. If it was actually being delivered by the seller, I think it would be taxed in virtually every state. But third-party delivery is, I think, Minnesota is kind of the exception there. And in fact, we are the exception even in Minnesota. We only tax third-party deliveries of aggregate and concrete block. No other commodity is taxed by third-party deliverers in Minnesota. Section 7 of the bill basically provide, or let me go back to Section 6. This would provide that bundle transactions are part of the sales tax base. Sections 10 and 19 also address bundle transactions. These are transactions where you have either taxable goods or services that are sold along with non-taxable tangible personal property, non-taxable services, or intangible property. And when they're sold for one combined price, then the whole package becomes subject to some exceptions in the bill. Then also we provide in Section 19, if in fact those exceptions apply and the bundle transaction is not taxed, the person making that transaction would have to pay use tax on those components if those components were over $100 at their cost or your sales price is over $100. Section 7 relates to delivery charges. It involves both taxable and non-taxable items, requiring you to prorate between the taxable and non-taxable items. Section 8 basically provides that prepaid calling cards are no longer treated as tangible personal property in Minnesota. They're not taxed as a service under the new streamlined language. Section 9 of the bill basically sets forth the new streamlined definition of telecommunications. Section 10, which I previously talked about, is a definition of a bundle transaction. It basically means where two or more products, which are distinct and identifiable, are sold for a non-itemized price. And this sets forth those three exceptions. One is the 10% de minimis test. There's a true object test and a 50% test when it involves medical items or food products. Sections 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17 deal with telecommunications. In those sections, we define what we mean by ancillary services, conference bridging services, detailed telecommunications billing services, directory assistance, vertical service, voicemail service, and ringtones. All these items are currently taxed under our current definition of telecommunications services and would be taxed under this new definition we're adopting from Streamline. We have, obviously have an option to whether to elect to tax these or not, but we're electing to tax these in the department's bill since they're currently taxed. Sections 18 and 26 relate to fur clothing, which Mr. Wilkie had previously mentioned to you. We would now be repeating the gross receipts tax on fur clothing and bring it back under the sales tax chapter. Section 19 refers to the provision I talked about previously, the use tax on items costing more than $100 and sold at more than $100 if they're part of a bundle transaction. Section 20 provides relief for sellers when they don't have an exemption certificate at the time of sale. This would basically give them 90 days after the date of sale to collect that certificate, or 120 days if the commissioner made a written request for that certificate. Currently, they have 60 days to produce it, so this would be basically tax-friendly provision for retailers. Sections 21, 22, 23, and 24 relate to prepaid and postpaid calling cards and clarifying that we're going to continue to tax those as telecommunication services. Section 25 basically says that ancillary services, which we previously talked about, would be sourced to the customer's primary place of use. Section 27 relates to breast pumps, which the department has previously treated as durable medical equipment. Streamline has now changed their definition as to, and they are no longer qualified as durable medical equipment, and we propose they now be included under the baby exemption and therefore continue their exempt status. Section 28 relates to advertising materials that are sent outside the state of Minnesota. Currently, the exemption applies to advertising materials and envelopes and reply envelopes. We're proposing that now be expanded to other types of items that might contain advertising materials, such as boxes, tubes, labels, and cartons that the advertising material may be within. And also, we were clarifying that there are certain printed materials that serve another legal purpose other than advertising that they would not qualify as advertising materials. These things would be insurance policies, the rebate checks, bills, brokerage statements, such as things such as that. Section 29 relates to packing materials used to move household goods outside the state of Minnesota, and we're clarifying that those packing materials must be transferred to the customer or the for-hire carrier and remain with that person, and that it would not include equipment actually owned by the moving van or moving company, such as tools, pads, or other equipment. Section 30 provides that cable television and direct satellite broadcasting services will be taxed, and they also will get there will be a capital equipment exemption for. They're no longer classified as telecommunication equipment, therefore we have to specifically now address them as qualifying for that exemption. Section 31 relates to hospitals and basically provides that hospitals and and outpatient surgical centers that merge with other nonprofit organizations will be treated as exempt hospital purchases if that combined nonprofit unit would have qualified as a nonprofit unit itself and those purchases would have qualified for the nonprofit exemption. Section 32 would preserve the exemption for private communication services purchased by the State Lottery Service. This is currently exempt under the sales tax. Section 33 provides the conditions to what would constitute a fully completed exemption certificate and provides that if the conditions for the purchaser change, it's required that they update the blanket exemption certificate. Section 34, I previously mentioned, this is the liquor reporting requirements for liquor wholesalers. Section 35, this would relate to motor carrier direct pay permit holders and specify that the only taxes that they could deduct from the sales price would be taxes imposed directly on the motor carrier and that are separately stated on the billing or invoice. Currently, the statute would allow them to deduct taxes imposed upon the retailer also. Section 36 is an exemption under Chapter 297B, the sales tax on motor vehicles. This provides an exemption for resale. The way the statute currently reads, it seems to say that the only vehicles that can be purchased for resale are those bearing dealer plates, and we know that's certainly not the case. It would clearly include vehicles bearing dealer plates, but also involve any vehicles purchased for resale in the regular course of business of a car dealer, used or new.
Mr. Chair.
Sir, Esquire.
Mr. Haugen. With regard to this provision, so you're a dealer and you've the owner and the sales manager or something, and they get their vehicle and they put their dealer plates on them, and they're basically driving them for their own cars. How are those vehicles dealt with?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, if they've actually put dealer plates on them, they're required to pay a substitute fee, a $20 fee, and as long as they bear dealer plates, they can use them for whatever requirements or for whatever purposes are allowed under the statute. In Chapter 168, there are specific requirements which vehicles can and cannot bear dealer plates, and that's something that would be regulated by public safety.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Section 38.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Heck, how does this change policy as it relates to pre-owned or used vehicles and how dealership resells those?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Larson, this wouldn't change that at all. We're basically, though, the statute seemed to be so tight before that it only applied to vehicles bearing dealer plates, and we just want to clarify that even if they don't bear dealer plates, if they sit on the dealer's lot, new or used, that the dealer can buy them except for resale, and they would collect tax on the ultimate sale, not on the intermediate sale. Section 38 is basically relates to the repeal of the fur tax, the gross earnings tax, gross receipts tax on furs, and sets up a final return schedule. And this did result in a $20,000 shift, which is reflected in the streamlined sales tax costs. The revenues are being shifted from one fiscal year into another. That's the reason for the cost. In the repealer, the first paragraph relates to the repeal of the fur holding tax. Paragraph B relates to repealing the definition of prepaid telephone calling cards, since they're no longer needed to be treated as tangible personal property. Paragraph C relates to multiple sourcing for multiple points of use on digital goods and computer software, which are now going to be sourced under the general sourcing rules. And the last repealer relates to items brought into the state by non-residents. We're repealing this because we feel it's no longer needed since Minnesota can only impose its use tax on items that are purchased to be used in Minnesota. If they're actually purchased by a non-resident used outside the state, we could never tax them when they came into the state anyway. That would conclude Article 2.
That's, Mr. Heck, that's interesting because when I bring things to my cabin in Canada, Ontario charges me their national sales tax. Even if I previously owned it, I have to declare a value on it and pay sales tax to bring it into Ontario. Why wouldn't we do that with something? Somebody from North Dakota has a cabin in Senator Scoy's district, and they decide to buy a new refrigerator and bring it to their cabin in Park Rapids. Why wouldn't we try, or can we just not figure out it's just uncollectible because we can't figure out the transactions? Or
Mr. Chairman, we would if you were actually a resident of Minnesota. Say you had a cabin in Wisconsin and had a boat there and you brought that boat back to Minnesota, we would do it. But under the current statutory law, if you're a non-resident, when you purchase that item, we basically would give full faith and credit that item wasn't purchased for use in Minnesota, and therefore, we have the statutory exemption on the books that if you're a non-resident at the time you bought it and later became a resident of Minnesota, the legislature elected not to tax those transactions.
Senator Limmer.
On that discussion point, do we have any separation as far as corporations that may want to do business in the state of Minnesota? Do we recognize their capital goods, some widget maker or a print machine or something, if they are moving from another state, taking their equipment here, do we capture any of that value when they come in?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limit, we would not be, for at least for sales tax purposes, if it had actually been put to use in the other state for a sufficient amount of time, if we knew that it was purchased outside the state and they purchased it with the intent to bring it into Minnesota, we could possibly pursue it, but if we could not show the intent that it had been purchased with the intent to use it in Minnesota, we could not impose our sales tax on that equipment coming into the state at a later point in time.
And Mr. Chair, would that be the burden of proof on the department to prove that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limerick, the burden would be initially on the taxpayer, but if they could show they'd use it outside the state a sufficient amount of time, whatever that amount of time is, they would have met their burden, and it would be shifted then back to the department. So.
Mr. Chair, I'm not encouraging it. I'm just probing the issue a little bit. We probably want to attract as many businesses to the state as possible. But, then we can tax them. But I'd like to have them get established here as easy as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Heck.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Pat Finnegan. I'll take you through Article 3, the special taxes article. Article 3 consists of a number of technical changes to various special taxes. The summary is outlined according to tax type, and so that's how I'll make the presentation. Section 1 deals with the Joint Underwriting Association. It simply adds a statutory reference which authorizes the Joint Underwriting Association offset to the insurance premiums tax. Section 2 repeals some archaic language to the reciprocal or interinsurance contract statute. Section 10 and 11 both deal with the fire insurance surcharge. Section 10 clarifies that none of the surcharges are subject to retaliation.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we have an amendment now that pertains to this section. It's the A07-0057. And this was just a compromise language that we worked out with the on the fire insurance surcharge. And this is a recommendation from the Fire Service Advisory Committee, which is chaired by Bob Johnson of the Insurance Federation.
Senator Limmer moves the A07-0057. Right, Senator Limmer?
Just catching up, Mr. Chair. Just got the amendment. I so move.
Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Section 11, Mr. Chairman, also deals with the fire insurance surcharge that was enacted last year. It clarifies that mutual property and casualty companies that are authorized to make an election must remit the total surcharge collected, and it clarifies the timelines for making the election. Section 12 deals with the Joint Underwriting Association offset, and it basically details when the offset can be claimed. It makes it similar to the time for the Guarantee Association assessment offset. Section 13 deals with the insurance premiums tax underpayment penalty. It contains a definition of tax used to calculate the underpayment. It includes retaliatory tax and certain credits if utilized, and also corrects an erroneous cross-reference. Section 14 is an insurance premiums tax penalty for failing to file information returns. It would authorize a penalty of $50 for failure to file information returns. Section 3, or the next two provisions, are D-tax proposals, Section 3 and Section 4. Section 3 is an exemption for redeeming debtors. It clarifies the exemption from D-tax for a debtor who redeems their property from a mortgage or other lien foreclosure sale. And the section ensures that the exemption only applies if the person who only applies to the person who used to own the property redeems it. And I think there's an amendment also related to that one that the department worked with the State Bar Association's real property section. It's the A1 amendment.
Thank you.
handed that out, members. Any?
Mr. Chair, I'd move the A1 amendment.
Mr. Senator moves the A1. Any questions? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, Section 4D deals with deeds from the state to governmental subdivisions for public use, and it has to do with the deed tax on conveyances of tax forfeited land to government subdivisions for authorized public uses, and just says that the deed tax is the minimum amount, which is $1.65. The next three provisions are Minnesota care.
Where did the $1.65 number come from?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the history of it. I just know that in the statute, it's always been $1.65 for the minimal deed tax. I'm not sure if anyone else from property tax might know.
Just curious. Senator Limmer?
Mr. Chair, I wanted to go back to that previous A1 amendment. Okay. I didn't get a copy of it by the time we voted, but it makes reference to section of law 580.23. And I'm wondering if we could find out what 580.23 is all about. I don't think we even talked about that in our discussion.
Mr. Chair, my name is Lance DeRica with the Department of Revenue. I worked on the deed tax provisions. Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't remember verbatim section 580.23. It has to do with foreclosures of mortgages by advertisement. You put notices in the paper and you mail a notice to the debtor. And again, I can't cite the statute to you right verbatim, but the concept is if I own a house and the bank forecloses on me, the sheriff conducts a sale, typically the bank will bid in the debt amount. And that is a transfer of property. The bank becomes the right to be the owner after my redemption period ends. If I redeem, that's not another transaction. That undoes the foreclosure. Statute 580.23 has to do with that concept and talks about owners. And so what we're trying to do here is the language in the bill, there was some concern. The language in the bill talks about successors and assigns of the debtor. So the concern was that before the foreclosure, if I own an office building, I could sell the office building to someone else subject to the mortgage. That we're okay with. That person has now become the owner. If they redeem, they shouldn't have to pay the deed tax to get their property back because, as I said, technically, under the law, that's not another transaction that undoes the first one. What we're concerned about is during the course of the foreclosure, if there's two or three creditors, the second creditor could come in, redeem, and then use this language to argue that they're entitled, that their redemption is entitled to be tax-free also. And so there was some concern about the language in the bill. We worked with the bar to get the new language. The new language is fairly new, a matter of days old, so you could see some change in it, but that was the concern, and that's the context. I hope I...
Mr. Chair, I'd probably want to review with the department this language specifically. As you may know, it's getting to be a rather robust market for foreclosure properties out there, and I have a particular client that I'm working with right now who got caught in a very bad transaction where they're now losing their property to what I would call an unsavory purchaser who, unfortunately, the seller in this case was hoping that they'd get a larger value. They were allowed to live in the property until they got their mortgage responsibilities repaired, and now they're in the point of being ousted from their home by a sheriff's order. And they never thought that they were into the type of transaction that got them there. And foreclosure is a difficult status to go through for a property owner, especially a homeowner. And at the same time, there is a contractual obligation to whoever holds the mortgage to be paid on their funds that are owed them. But there are some third parties that come along and take great advantage of the situation. And before I really give it a full blessing on this particular amendment, I think we need to visit that. I'll do it individually with the department to really understand what's going on, but we may want to revisit this particular thing one more time so we know absolutely what we're really doing. And I at least will admit that I don't know what I'm doing on this particular amendment.
The department could do that with Senator Limmer. That would be helpful.
All right.
The next three sections deal with the Minnesota Care Tax. Section 5 clarifies that an individual that receives drugs from a non-resident pharmacy is not subject to tax. That was a law change in 2005, I believe, and we're reflecting that here. Section 6 clarifies that a non-resident pharmacy is not required to collect the use tax since individuals who purchase the drugs for their own use are no longer required to pay the tax. The non-resident pharmacies are not required to collect it either. Section 7 clarifies that the refund claim by pharmacies for amounts paid for drugs delivered outside of Minnesota will be applied against the health care provider tax. Under current law, the refund was applied against the pharmacy tax, but that's been repealed there. The last two sections deal with cigarette and tobacco tax. Section 8 is a tobacco products use tax provision. It amends the statute to limit the exemption for tobacco products use tax to $50, provided that the products are carried into the state by the consumer. That would be similar to the use tax exemption for cigarette tax. Section 9 is a cigarette consumer use tax. In 2005, the cigarette sales tax was moved from the retail to the wholesale level. What this does is just require cigarette consumers' use tax on consumer use of cigarettes if the cigarette sales tax has not been paid. It was basically an oversight when that change was made in earlier on the sales tax that the use tax was not also put in there.
Very good. Any other questions on Article 3, members? If not, maybe, Mr. Manson, maybe we'll pick up with Article 4 tomorrow.
Sure.
I believe it's tomorrow. Tomorrow morning, same time.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, members. This meeting's adjourned.